Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlines between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, our topic today is something that was sparked by the recent incident that took up about 3 weeks of time in the atheist and skeptic communities, and that was Elevator Gate.
Oh, gossips.
Yes. So the incident has been thoroughly discussed on many, many blogs and comment threads and articles. I wrote an article about it myself for Religion Dispatches. But the episode's not about Elevator Gate per se. It's just sparked by Elevator Gate. We want to talk about women in skepticism and whether there are things that are happening in the skeptic movement that make women feel less welcome, or more broadly, why women are less fully represented in the skeptic movement and in science in general.
And we're lucky enough to have a woman as a co-host on the show.
Cool. Where is she?
We don't need to talk about that. No, but you're right. So part of the issue here is actually a broader underrepresentation of women, not just in skepticism, but in sort of science-related stuff, including science itself.
And they're totally not independent issues either, because right. A lot of the leading figures in the skeptic movement are scientists or science writers. So, you know, right. And a lot of the material that gets covered in the skeptic movement is about science. So. Right. One would expect those two issues to be intertwined.
So for the rest of the show, we're going to try to avoid a Larry Summers moment and make statements that are unsubstantiated by science. We'll just stick to your personal experience and to what we actually know about the skeptic community.
Not to do exactly what you just told me not to do, but
okay.
But Larry Summers was speculating on potential genetic causes for for the gap in between men and women in the sciences. So I'm just to check on the ground rules, are we allowed to speculate?
I think we should speculate. We're not the president of Harvard, after all.
All right.
Now, we just said we're not going to talk about Elevator Gate, but there's a possibility that one or two of our listeners don't actually know what Elevator Gate was.
Sure, so like maybe someone was in a coma for the last month.
Yes. So why don't we just briefly summarize without obviously adjudicating things, and then move from there.
Okay, so Elevator Gate, at the end of June, I think, Rebecca Watson, who hosts Skeptic and is a major figure at a bunch of Skeptic conferences and on the web, posted a video blog complaining about an incident that had happened to her at an atheist conference in Dublin, in which she had been on a panel and she'd been talking about some of the difficult like experiences that women have to deal with in the Skeptic and atheist movements. About being objectified and that sort of thing. And then at the end of the day, she's hanging out with people in the hotel lounge. She announces she's going up to bed. It's like 4 a.m. at that point. She gets in the elevator, and one of the guys from the crowd who was at the conference and who had seen her speak on the panel earlier that day gets into the elevator with her. And as the elevator is going up, he asks her, he says, "I think you're really interesting. Would you like to come up to my room for coffee?" She says, "No." They leave it at that. She goes to her room, and then she posts this video blog saying that, you know, this was sort of inappropriate and made me feel uncomfortable. It was clearly a proposition, and I was, you know, a single woman alone in a foreign country in an enclosed space, i.e. the elevator. And, you know, even men who don't mean any harm should stop and think about the fact that women, this may make women nervous because they don't know whether you mean any harm or not. And being in an enclosed space and being propositioned is, you know, understandably nerve-wracking. I don't know if she said all of that right then, but she might have. I think she explained it more in a follow-up post.
We should clarify that the video that you're referring to is about 20 minutes long, but that episode, it's only a very brief part.
Right, good point. It was sort of an aside, like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Guys, don't do that." And so this sparked sort of a minor debate on various atheist and skeptic blogs about how reasonable her objection was. And then that minor debate turned into a major debate when Richard Dawkins chimed in a comment thread, basically sort of sarcastically chiding her for overreacting, essentially.
Sort of a hypothetical letter to a Muslim woman.
Saying essentially, dear Muslim woman, yes, you have all of these problems like getting stoned for being raped and having your genitals cut off. But look at me, I have problems like being propositioned in elevators. So why don't you stop whining? It was a pretty sarcastic post. So
why does that not surprise me from Richard Dawkins? But that's a different question. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Let's leave that aside. So 3-4 weeks of debate over whether men have the right to proposition women, regardless of the fact that it might make some women uncomfortable, whether women have the right to tell men to adjust their behavior because it makes the women uncomfortable, whether men have the right to tell women how they should or should not feel about in situations such as this, how realistic is it for a woman in such a situation as Watson's to be concerned? Because I think a lot of the people who felt that Watson was overreacting and that men shouldn't have to change their behavior in situations such as that felt that that it just wasn't a realistic concern, that like the chance of being attacked by a stranger in an elevator was so low that it wasn't really, a realistic reaction for her to be nervous. Mm-hmm. And other people insisted that, yes, it very much is.
Would you say that many fairly prominent figures in, people in the skeptic movement, both men and women, have commented on this thing? My take on it is that the overwhelming majority were actually concerned about Rebecca. Taking Rebecca's side.
But, yeah, that sounds about right to me. Right? That's an accurate description of...
But what actually concerned me, and which is why I think we're talking about it today, it's two things, actually. There's two connections. One of them is, regardless of the specifics of the, let's say, the Watson-Dawkins debate, leaving that aside, what was actually disturbing to see was the tone of a lot of the comments posted by users of several of these blogs where these discussions were going on. So I'm not talking about the main posts, I'm talking about the commenters.
Mm-hmm. The comment threads were running thousands and thousands of comments in
right.
some cases.
And of course, I have not read all of them by any stretch, but a good number of them were very ugly, clearly misogynist, clearly sexist, clearly, even in some cases, clearly suggesting the threat of violence against Rebecca. I think it exposed an interesting and ugly underbelly of part, of course, of the skeptic and atheist community, which is why I think this has become such a big issue. That brings me to the second connection. The reason I brought up this topic for the show was not originally because of Elevatorgate, but because I was reading a interesting post about women in science by Jennifer Hulett, who writes a blog called Cocktail Party Physics for Scientific American. And I was there. The blog starts with an interesting story about a woman named Linda Henneberg, who is a science communication intern at CERN in Switzerland. And it was talking about how she felt a bit of a chilly climate about for women at CERN. This fits into actually a general broader concern in the physics community. Even the American Physics Association has noticed this and has attempted to implement policies to encourage women in physics and also to sort of teach men in physics how to behave or how to make the environment more welcome for women. And then in the middle of this article, Hulett turned to Elevatorgate, and I said, holy cow, this thing is actually made into Scientific American.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting connection. Then all of a sudden, a writer who was actually interested started out by talking about women in physics, therefore more broadly women in science, made immediately the connection with women in skepticism. And of course, as you were mentioning earlier, there is obvious connection because there's quite a bit of overlap in terms of interest and even people mm-hmm. Between the two communities. But this is the first time that I actually saw something that I thought was pretty limited in scope and internal to the skeptic community, which after all is pretty small, actually getting that kind of exposure. And but I think that what we should, as I said, focus on it. It's really the broader issue, certainly not the Elevatorgate thing. And one of the things that I wanted to discuss a little bit was a couple of things that were mentioned by Hulett before she gets into Elevatorgate, and particularly the experiences of Bernice Sandler, who is a feminist icon, and she's now a senior scholar at the Women's Research and Education Institute in Washington, D.C. And there's a couple of interesting anecdotes that the blog, the Scientific American blog, reports about Sandler. And let me read you briefly what she says so that we can maybe chat about it a little bit. Sandler told the author of the Scientific American blog that she first encountered the chilly climate for women as a feminist activist in the 1970s, sitting in a policy meeting in which she noticed that the few token women in the room were constantly being interrupted by the men. She decided to perform her own little social experiment, carefully keeping count of the number of times both men and women in the meeting were interrupted. The results were, I would say, pretty obvious. Women are interrupted invariably by men at least 3 times more than others, than men are interrupted. This is not surprising. What was interesting was what Sandra did as a follow-up to that. She shared her results with her male colleagues, the article goes on to say, who were predictably, of course, defensive, claiming that she must have miscounted or been biased in some way because, of course, that would never be. They would never do such a thing. Again, this is not surprising. What's surprising is what happened next. The next day, the blog continues, when the meeting resumed, the men were far more careful not to interrupt women when the women were speaking. And so Sandler got these realization, these aha moment where she realized that this is actually changeable behavior. What I thought was interesting in there was the psychological dynamics, right? So somebody comes in, measures a particular phenomenon, shares that information with the people affected. The immediate reaction is the predictable one. I wouldn't do that. Surely there's a mistake in the data. But apparently at some level, they actually got either consciously or unconsciously aware of you know, once made aware of this phenomenon, this problem, potential problem, that actually changed the behavior immediately the following day. Now, I don't know how, you know, lasting that change was, of course, and that sort of thing. But to me, that suggests that perhaps a lot of this stuff could be avoided or at least minimized simply by pointing out data, pointing out behavior, which of course would be the sort of rational and skeptical and scientific way to do things. But I get the impression that a lot of people...
It's tough, though, because how do you compare... I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Not to interrupt you. Just trying to even out the numbers here. It's tough because a lot of the behaviors that people consider chilly to women aren't the sort of thing that you could do a comparison to see whether they happen more to women than to men, because it's sort of a woman-specific... Like, women getting hit on, for example. It's a really common complaint I've heard. Are we going to compare how often men are hit on by women to how often women are hit on by men? Like, clearly that's already asymmetric in the population as a whole. And I don't know that we'd want to take that as evidence of sexism or misogyny if men hit on women more than women hit on men. The interruption is sort of a nice, clean example because interruption itself is not a gendered activity, right?
Right.
Oh, I wonder with the interruptions whether part of that imbalance could have been explained by the fact that men just interrupt anyone more than women interrupt people.
I'm not positive about this, but I think that actually the count was separate for, you know, the count was of how many times men interrupted other men as well as opposed to other how many times they interrupted women. So it wasn't just a matter of interrupting in general.
It would still result in an imbalance if... Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I've heard similar complaints. I'm sure that this is a real phenomenon. I wonder also, so there was a great comment from someone on the teaser post about this episode. Gil asked whether women have different experiences in the skeptic movement that they don't have otherwise. So, for example, he says, Rebecca Watson reported getting harassing emails from readers and about men always trying to hit on her in skeptic meetings. And Gil says, well, this sounds like something that most women experience elsewhere regardless. Does being involved in skepticism confer some unique experiences? And I think this is an important question if we're interested in whether the skeptic movement has like a woman problem, because there is some base level in the population as a whole of these kinds of incidents. So if we want to say that the skeptic movement has a problem, it seems like we would have to be claiming that it happens more in the skeptic movement or in a different way or in some way that's different from the population base.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
This is something that I had actually noticed recently in a totally different context. I'm leaving for Burning Man in just a couple of days, actually, which is this big festival in the desert. And some people were talking about injuries
at Burning
Man.
Where there is, I understand, naked dancing and orgies. Oh, there's no, that wasn't it.
No, there's definitely some of that, but it's not only that. There's also a lot of leaders of the tech industry. Thank you. leaders in tech and science and the media who come out, and a lot of artists who bring in. Anyway, it's a really cool festival, not to get on a tangent. But it's also this huge, like, 50,000-person city out in the desert. And so people were talking about the danger at Burning Man, dangers of dehydration or danger of injury or the amount of deaths and injuries at Burning Man. And so it sounds a little bit... a little scary, but then when you actually look at the numbers, you have to check what would the expected death and injury rate be of a typical city of 50,000 people over the period of a week, which is how long Burning Man lasts. And once you compare it to that, it's actually not more dangerous than being in a regular city of 50,000 people. The type of deaths or and injuries might be different for Burning Man versus a the control of a 50,000 person city normally. But if you want to say that Burning Man is dangerous, it has to be different. It has to be
More dangerous. In the case of that's a good point. In the case of the skeptic movement, we don't have obviously. I mean, nobody that I know has done systematic research on this, so we don't really have the comparison numbers. But I think that the concern is coming out actually in some sense from a different perspective. That is, shouldn't the skeptic movement have fewer problems than other communities? Precisely because skeptics and atheists and humanists and all these other aggregated, associated things, people, they think of themselves as particularly aware of social problems. They think of themselves as rational. They think of themselves as particularly open about, equal gendered and so on and so forth. So the idea, I think, is that even if you actually could show that the number of incidents of these kinds is no larger in the skeptic community than it is in the community at large, that still would be worrisome because the expectation wouldn't be of equality. It would be actually that this should be a more welcoming place, a more open place. Now,
I see.
If it's not, then one would have to revise, I guess, one's assumptions about what exactly it is that skeptics and atheists actually think.
Yeah. Even if men, let's take the example of men hitting on women. So a lot of women have complained that they get hit on sort of at an overwhelming rate at skeptic events, and that drives them away. And so even if you had men hitting on women at the same rate that they hit on women outside of the skeptic community, just by the fact that women are a minority means that the women are going to feel overwhelmed by the come-ons. Right. So that is sort of a structural problem that doesn't result from behavior that's any different in the skeptic movement versus outside of the skeptic movement.
No, that's a good point. You were asking a minute ago about what other kinds of behaviors are that then interrupting, a speaker, for instance.
Yeah.
And so the article by Hulette does mention a few.
Just talking about science here?
Yes, we're talking about science in general. We're talking about physics in particular. So she does discuss what constitutes a chilling behavior. And examples are not just in professional science, but also in education in general. So she says, a teacher calling boys in class more often than girls, for instance. That's a chilling behavior, an example of chilling behavior. Outside of science, a CEO who ignores a woman in a meeting but listens intently to whatever a man says, especially when they're making similar points. A conference MC that mentions a female speaker's appearance, as opposed to how many times you do that for a man, that sort of thing. And then, of course, her last example was a guy at an atheist skeptics meeting hitting on a young woman in an elevator at 4 a.m. in the morning. And
transitions into elevator gate,
into that. So those are all kind of sort of chilling behaviors. And it's not necessarily, in fact, I don't think the implication here is that they're done necessarily consciously. But I'm sure sometimes they are. But broadly speaking, is that, these are behaviors that it's very, very easy not to be aware of. Because if a behavior or a certain attitude toward a particular topic is embedded in the culture, you just don't think about it twice. You don't stop and say, there is a second article that I'd like to mention that made some interesting points in this respect. This is by Jen McCrate, who is a self-described liberal, geeky, nerdy, scientific, perverted feminist atheist.
She writes at Black Hag.
Right. And so she wrote an entry on July 15, 2010, so we're talking about a little bit ago, about TAM 8, the Amazing Meeting 8, which is the one previous to this year. And she asked the same question about that meeting. Why is it that there are so few women, not only in the audience, but also among the presenters? And I'll get to some interesting data that she actually collected at that conference in a minute. But one of her observations was that some of the perpetrators are major figures in skepticism. And she mentions two by name. One of them is a man, one is a woman, actually. And I'm pretty sure that her idea wasn't to say, well, these people do it on purpose. It's just that, look, even people who are prominent speakers who ought to know better, they just don't think about it. The first culprit was Michael Shermer, who apparently, including in a video, a situation where a, quote, hot hair-haired women are used as examples of people who aren't critical thinkers.
Well, I saw that video.
Yeah, I was there too.
Yeah. So he wasn't saying that hot women are an example.
I know.
I don't know exactly what Jen wrote, but just to...
No, so she didn't write that. That's exactly the point, in fact, that I'm sure if you ask Michael, you know, we both know him. If you ask him, you know, what did you do that? Was that, what was your intention? He would say, no, absolutely, that was not my intention. The question here is, well, why would you use, however, that kind of imagery in order to sort of characterize, even in you know, in within a talk given to a skeptic meeting, that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. And it gets more interesting, actually, with another speaker, Harriet Hall, who is, of course, a woman. And she apparently did the same thing. For instance, sometimes she mentioned Jenny McCarthy, the famous mother who claims that
vaccines cause
autism. Jenny McCarthy in her talk is an example of someone saying something stupid, but she would include a picture of her bending over in a bikini or in some other scantily clad outfit. She says, well, why not showing Jenny McCarthy in a suit? And I checked. There are pictures on Google.
Right, or just a headshot.
Or something like that. Right, exactly.
So the question is, why are... You can talk about stupidity or ignorance without linking it to sexiness or femininity.
Yes, or, you know, right. For instance, why don't you say, you know, look at these stupid behavior, these stupid things said by X, and show, you know, a man drinking a beer, for instance. That would be a pretty good icon of stupidity. but it doesn't happen. Right. That's the idea.
Right. Yeah, I mean...
You know, it's hard to question... This is not a questioning of intentions. It's a question of, I think, similar to the example that I brought up earlier, of certain behaviors come automatically, and I'm sure people would be defensive about it if the beer were to be pointed out to them and say, no, that's not what I meant. Well, that may not be what you meant, but the subliminal... broadly speaking, message is of that type.
I think a lot of the anger that surrounded the question of that Rebecca Watson sparked in Elevator Gate and other debates on similar topics, the anger, I think, came from disagreements over whose side the responsibility fell on to remedy situations like this. So there's a difference between saying to someone, hey, this behavior you're doing is making me uncomfortable, would you mind stopping? Which doesn't imply that they have an obligation to stop, versus saying, hey, you're doing this thing wrong, you need to stop because, you know, right, you're like infringing on my rights. And these are not legal rights, and they're not sort of basic human rights in the sense that we usually use the term. They're just sort of social rights. There's this general set of expectations that we have about how society works and how people are supposed to treat each other. And again, these aren't laws, just social rules, social norms. And so I think, so the way Rebecca phrased her original comment was, guys, don't do this. And the way it often got phrased when it was discussed in blogs and articles was, you know, guys, you should know better than to do this. Like, you have an obligation to stop this if it makes women uncomfortable. And I think that was what a lot of people disputed. Right. So I don't really...
I think I like your way to put it, actually. You're right. These are certainly... There's no fundamental right that is being infringed upon here. It is a matter of social rights. I like that phrase.
Some of the commenters instantly took it to the whole, well, it's a free country, which, yes, it's true, and that's totally beside the point.
Exactly.
We're not talking about there. You have a legal right to hit on someone.
This reminds me actually of what was happening fairly often when I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I would have what I thought polite confrontations with creationists in public places, mm-hmm. you know, like debates and things like that. I was trying to be polite, but certain people get offended just because you mention an idea. I mean, I actually mm-hmm. run into people who said, you know, the very mentioning of, you know, the possibility that the Bible is not inerrant, for instance, it's an offense to me. Mm-hmm. And several people approached me suggesting that they had a constitutional right not to be offended. And
wow.
Yes.
I must not have read the Constitution very closely in
correct.
Eighth grade.
In fact, my response was, actually, if we really want to be constitutional about it, I have a constitutional right to offend you whatever the hell I please. Now, there is a different question there, whether that is a good thing to do or not, whether it actually, you know, it achieves some kind of objective. And it's also there is also a question of whether it is polite. It's the nice thing
right.
to do. But you certainly don't have a right not to be offended. So I think that there is a situation. This is a similar situation. I mean, I don't think that anybody could push the issue to the point of saying, look, women have a right to certain kinds of behaviors from men. But expectations, social expectations are different. They're weaker. That doesn't mean that they're not effective, however, because or that they're not, they don't have consequences. So but,
yeah.
but your way to look at it, I think it's interesting.
Yeah, and I just, it made me uncomfortable when people would talk about the situations like this in terms of, look, if someone's offended, then you need to stop.
No, not necessarily.
Because,
right.
Yeah, so there's a spectrum. I mean, the question of whether this is a reasonable reaction from Watson is relevant. I mean,
sure.
Like you could, if someone said, well, it makes me, if a group of people even said, well, it makes me uncomfortable when you look at me because it makes me nervous.
Right.
I think we would feel like that was less of a reasonable reaction. Obviously, what Watson said is not that unreasonable or not
right.
unreasonable like that. But then there's this whole spectrum, you know, and the other end, there's like people who pull out a fake gun and point it at your head. And you know, we would feel it's a very reasonable thing to feel like that's, you
absolutely.
Know, a threatening behavior. So
exactly.
somewhere on that spectrum of reasonableness of objection is a line that we sort of collectively have to draw about what's a reasonable objection. And there's not an obvious right answer to that.
No, that's right. Now, since we are in a podcast about science and skepticism as mm-hmm. well as philosophy, let's get to some data. We said earlier that there is not a lot of data. Actually, at least none that I could find. But there's a couple of things I want to mention and see how do you react. One more thing from Jen McCrae's article about TAM 8. She actually collected data about, which is not that difficult to do, I have to say, about presenters at TAM 8. And mm-hmm. And the first thing she noticed was that overall there were in fact significantly more men presenting than women. I should add, by the way, that apparently the situation has improved significantly at TAM 9, and in part of that is because DJ Grothy, who is one of the major organizers there, was very conscious about this kind of thing. So he actually went out of his way to invite as many women presenters as he could think of. So the TAM organizers, this is what I'm about to say, it's not at all a criticism of the TAM organizers. It's just a matter of, okay, let's take a look at that at a particular snapshot, which was at TAM 8. Now, what was interesting was when the data were broken down in the following way, talks, panel discussions, and workshops. And if you do it that way, it turns out that if you're looking at talks, the number of men is overwhelmingly higher than the number of women. If you move to panel discussions, there's still a difference, but it's less so. So there's still more men than women, but the gap is being reduced. And if you're talking about workshops, that is actually essentially equal numbers. Now, I'm not sure what to make of this, but it does seem to show that the more you move, there's at least two ways to interpret it. The more you move toward more social events, I would say the panel discussions and then workshops are more social, less mm-hmm. they're less focused on one person. The more there are women participants. By the same token, however, typically, having been at many of these conferences, the talks are assumed to be or considered to be more important or more prominent,
more prestigious.
Kind of most prestigious mm-hmm. things, then the panel discussions next, and then the workshops usually last.
Right, right.
That's the same, by the way, in science. It's
sure.
not just a matter of skepticism. So one can draw different conclusions, I suppose, from this kind of data in that respect. But it's an interesting observation that things are not, once you divide the numbers, things are not quite equally distributed, regardless of the type of event. So this could be simply useful for the organizers. right, to know that the workshops are, they're fine with the workshops. They should be more careful with the panel discussions and much more careful with the talks.
Right. And just to be clear, organizers, they choose who to invite, right? This is not women choosing what they wanted, right?
No, that's right. I think this is the organizers have pretty much complete control of what they invite, who they invite, and what they invite the person for. Yeah.
So a couple brief observations about that. Mm-hmm. First, there could easily, I would think, be a feedback loop in which if things got off on this foot at one point, in which women were sort of put in panels and men put in speaking positions, then I could imagine future organizers easily falling into the pattern of thinking, well, you know, women prefer to be on panels, or not even consciously necessarily, just associating women with panels, because that's what they've seen so far. And then the other observation is, it's tricky to figure out how much responsibility the skeptic movement bears if there, you know, to the extent that there are inequalities, gender inequalities in cases like this, if science itself is unbalanced and we're drawing, you know, our speakers from that pool, then, you know, if we were paying, even if we didn't know anything about gender, we would still end up with more men than women because there are more men in science than women. So it's just, I think it's important to keep stuff in mind, keep stuff like this in mind when we're thinking about blame, just because it's one question, it's one thing to say, do we want to have more women in our movement than men? It's another one to say, is it our fault that there are not as many women in our movement as there are men?
That is correct. The same exact discussion goes, for instance, when we're talking about ethnic differences. Yeah, it's a pretty obvious observation, for instance, that in science, in academic departments in general, not just sciences, but in academic departments in general, there are very few blacks compared to Caucasians. Now, that's certainly not a good situation, but it's not entirely to blame on discrimination or entirely to blame on, you know,
the discrimination in the sense of discrimination of, like, the hiring committees.
That's right, or hiring committees or something like that, because, in fact, I can guarantee you at this point that any university that would be very, very glad to get any minority, in fact, there's a lot of programs for hiring minorities, specifically for hiring minorities. Often, however, it's difficult to fill those positions. And the reason for that is because there's few people in that area, and that is because of a series of complex social causes that go all the way back to, you know, elementary education. Mm-hmm. So there is discrimination at some level, but it's not necessarily at the level of the organizing committee or the level of the hiring committee.
Right. I think we should probably talk. We should make sure we talk about issue, like, reasons why there might be fewer women in science and skepticism.
That's right. And that reminds me of the last piece of sort of evidence, although this is more anecdotal, that I wanted to bring up. Mm-hmm. There's an old article that appeared in March 1996, so this is definitely old, by Diane Weimer. And it was published. This was published in FACT, which is spelled P-H-A-C-T. Mm-hmm. And it's the publication of the Philadelphia Association for Critical Thinking. Even at that point, at that time in 96, there was this discussion going on in the skeptical community about why are there so few women in skepticism. And so Weimer did some sort of informal survey. We can post the link directly to the article. It's in two parts. And she basically started collecting suggestions or responses from people about why do you think that there is this distinction, this difference in the numbers between men and women. And I read you some of the responses in that she received, and we can talk about how much sense they make or they don't make. So number one, skeptics are largely drawn from the hard sciences or philosophical areas which are dominated by men. So in other words, that's what you were doing, were saying earlier, that this is simply a reflection that science at large or the academy at large is dominated by men, and therefore that's where the bias comes from. So it's not skepticism per se, the result of science. Number two, the structure of skeptics organizations, and this was specific to the way in which the former PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which is now CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Investigation, the way they created and structured the local skeptic groups, the suggestion was that may affect the gender makeup. For instance, the group are started typically by simply sending a mail to local subscribers of magazines like Skeptical Inquirer. Since it turns out that most of the subscribers are males, then therefore most of the time it's the male that starts the group, and so on and so forth. The dynamics goes from there. The third suggested explanation is that there is an increasing demand placed upon women in the workplace and at home, and so they just don't have the time. Meaning that men don't share, typically still in our society, the same amount of work home at home. And so if in a couple, in a family, both people work and they have full-time jobs, then it turns out that on top of that, the woman typically, not always, but typically does a lot, if not all, of the home-related stuff, including, of course, taking care of children and so on and so forth. So, you know, you just don't have the time.
We could test that one by looking at, say, student groups to see.
Yes.
I mean, because if student groups are also unbalanced, then that sort of takes some of the wind out of the sails of the homemaking hypothesis.
It does. Of course, you know, that we have to remember that these are not mutually exclusive hypotheses. So might need actually a multifactorial sort of analysis of variance to figure out what's going on there. But you're right, that it's certainly not the exclusive explanation. The fourth possibility was that women think differently than men do, which, of course, comes up often in these in these kind of discussions. And one of the respondents to the survey said, you know, because they are above all that, or conversely, that they are inherently logical creatures. In other words, the two explanations are either women just don't care because they're superior to these kind of things. They're not concerned with silly things like skepticism and critical thinking. Or they're just illogical. And, you know, after all, there is, in fact, and this is true, evidence that women have nationwide a higher belief in the paranormal than men do. This is, in fact, the case. So
I've heard that too, but I don't know exactly what they're referring to by paranormal, because I know that there are types of paranormal belief that are more dominated by men. Like, if you've ever been to a Bigfoot convention or you know, UFO, belief in UFOs, that's definitely more male than women.
Absolutely.
But of course, women are also more likely to believe in astrology, say.
That's right.
So I don't know how, if you were to lump them all together, figure out all of the different paranormal beliefs and then break them down by gender.
I've seen data about that. And it turns out that both things are true. That is, it is absolutely correct, as you said, that there is a distinction, a gender distinction, between the types of paranormal beliefs that people tend to gravitate toward. But it is also true that if you compile the data together, women do come ahead, not by much. I mean, we're talking about a few percentage points in the population. So, you know, does that contribute to the explanation?
Well,
possibly.
There's a big judgment call about what to include in your set of illogical beliefs. Like, would you include conspiracy theories? They're not necessarily paranormal, but, you know, maybe if you included those, the numbers would shift to being more men than women and, you know, illogical beliefs. Right. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
And then lastly, the last possibility is that women simply handle social interactions differently and they're not interested in conflict. And skeptical organizations, publications, and all that are a lot about conflict.
That is true, I think. I mean, anecdotally, that seems
anecdotal,
true.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So what's been your experience then in about all of this? Well, let's get a little more personal. So how did you get to begin with into this? And you ever felt a discrimination? That's without naming names, of course. We don't want to set another elevator gate.
So I should say, starting off, that I definitely can't speak for all women. And, you know, my experience is, who knows how representative it is of other women's experience. I tend to, this is not what you were doing, but I tend to get frustrated when people talk about women's experience or when they ask me to, you know, how women experience something. Because maybe my experience is going to be slightly more likely to represent other women's experience than the experience of a typical man.
Right.
Just because, you know, I'm probably going to have at least a little bit more similarity with your, you know, typical other women. But not a lot. I mean, I'm still not at all confident in my ability to predict how other women experience things.
That's right. It's a similar thing when people assume that because I'm Italian, I'm a representative of Italians. And
sure,
I keep telling them that actually the very fact that I moved to the United States for
certain
academic career means that I'm not.
That's a good point. I guess I don't really have anything like that, since there's nothing that makes me obviously unrepresentative of other women. But, I mean, I've never... To my knowledge, I've never been discriminated against in the skeptic movement or really in life. I mean, I exist in a pretty sexism-free world, as far as I can tell.
You live in New York City.
No, it's absolutely true. I grew up just outside of Washington, D.C., in, you know, one of the most, like, progressive and well-off and well-educated suburbs, and I went to school in Manhattan, and then I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then to New Haven, and then back to Manhattan. So there's, that's definitely not representative. But I mean, okay, so just talking about the skeptic world, people hit on me sometimes. I mean, it doesn't bother me per se. That's not to say that other women who are bothered by it are wrong in any way.
Right.
I find it pretty easy to deflect when it does bother me. So, you know, it's also possible that being young and female has hurt me in some ways that I will never know about. I mean, maybe there are people who don't take me as seriously as they would have because I'm young and female, or positions I could have had that I wasn't offered. I might not ever know about those things. But I mean, I've never felt unwelcome at all.
Well, okay, so we have at least one good story, as a sample size of one, which is optimistic. So I
am careful to sort of curate my public persona in a way, just because I have heard other stories from other women. So, for example, I have a lot of Facebook friends who aren't personal friends of mine, but who are readers of the blog or listeners of the podcast or who've met me at a conference or something like that.
Right.
I'd say probably at least 1,000 people I've never met are my Facebook friends. And I often post links to my blog posts or podcast links, that sort of thing, articles I've written. And there are sometimes comments that refer to my looks or that are sort of like winky or flirty, and I delete those instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I think it probably is pretty easy for people to see comments like that and start to think on some level that the woman the comments are addressed to is inviting them
right.
in some way.
Yeah, see, I don't have that problem. I don't get many flirty comments.
Yeah.
The ones that I get, I leave them there. I actually, you know, I like them.
Set up a little shrine to them. Delete new posts just so that one stays
so
up.
It stays
right?
up. Exactly, that sort of thing. Okay. Well, that's as I said, that's a good thing to know that at least some experiences have been positive. And
yeah,
it'd be interesting for somebody to actually do a serious study. However, you know, this is probably not just skepticism in particular, but science in general. This is probably the kind of topic that I would think that some serious social research could be done. And especially when looking at micro communities like the skeptic community or the atheist community. Another possibility, for instance, is that there are differences between the skeptic and the atheist community or between the atheist and the psycho-humanist communities. Because the members of those communities, although the membership overlaps quite a bit, they do see themselves as significantly different in terms of general attitude toward, you know, life, the universe, and everything. So it's possible that even gender issues might be different.
Can I make a couple takeaways here before we wrap up?
Sure.
So two things that I would want to, you know, leave other people with are, first, that I wish that we could have these discussions, you know, these internet-wide, blog-wide discussions without people jumping on other people for expressing skepticism, say, about
yeah,
some of
think.
Their claims about how people should act or how, you know, most quote-unquote women feel. Because I have talked to a lot of people who I consider very rational and very thoughtful and very considerate people in private who've said that they've disagreed with some of the things that have been said on the blogs, but they don't feel comfortable saying so publicly because they're going to be pilloried. And I've had discussions with people where I've questioned some political or ideological belief that they have, and it's become very emotional very quickly. So I really wish we could have these discussions without that happening.
Which you would think in a community that prides itself in rationalism would be possible, but apparently not so easy.
Yeah. And then the last thing is just that I think that it's easy to forget that when we're talking about differences between men and women, that does not necessarily mean innate differences. As we've discussed in earlier episodes of the podcast, it's really hard to separate out genetic from socialized differences between men and women. So even if we were to say that, you know, I don't know, women are more concerned with maintaining sort of social order and therefore less inclined to challenge illogical beliefs, that's not necessarily a statement about women's genetic disposition to do so.
That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. I've said my piece. We are all out of time. So let's wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a set of essays. They're all online, but they're also collected in a book. The author is a guy named Paul Graham, who's a computer programmer, a really brilliant entrepreneur, and currently runs a startup incubator called Y Combinator. He is also known for co-founding ViaWeb and inventing Bayesian spam filters. Really clever guy. And so he's written a bunch of essays on society and culture and programming and also rationality. So they're really clear and well-written and thoughtful essays. He's got kind of a large following. And there's a couple in particular that I think that listeners of this podcast might be interested in. One of them is called What You Can't Say, and it's about learning to recognize the areas of belief that are sort of taboo, or the opinions you hold that are socially determined because you don't feel comfortable considering alternates to, you know, what is socially acceptable. And so he talks about ways to recognize those kinds of beliefs and start, you know, picking away at them. And he's written an essay on lies we tell to kids. So he talks about potential consequences of lying to kids about how the world works, or even about things that seem more lighthearted, like about Santa Claus. And he makes a case against that. So I would recommend going to paulgraham.com and clicking on essays.
Okay. My pick is a book that came out fairly recently. It's called Not For Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. And it is really, it's by Martin Nussbaum, who is a prominent contemporary philosopher. It's really intended consciously as a manifesto in defense of liberal arts education in general and the humanities in particular. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, it's very well argued. It's an interesting book. It's not very long. It's less than a couple hundred pages. And it covers very, different aspects of the psychology of and sociology of teaching. It deals with recent trends in teaching, and it does deal a little bit with the sort of background history of how do we get a liberal arts education to begin with. For instance, in the United States, this was largely, not exclusively, but largely the result of the huge influence of John Dewey, pragmatist philosopher. At any rate, Nussbaum does a good job. The question is, at defending, I think, liberal arts education, the question is, why does liberal arts education need defending? And I've been experiencing this myself, not only in my own institution, but talking to colleagues and following, sort of articles in places like the Chronicle of Higher Education and so on and so forth. There's been, throughout the Western world, this is not just an American thing. In England, a very similar thing is happening. There's been a pretty much systematic cutting of humanities teaching and support on university campuses. Several philosophy departments, for instance, have been closed recently in British universities. And even in the United States, there's a lot of reforms that are aiming at reducing the importance of general education courses, which typically tend to be philosophy, arts, languages, for instance, things like that, or the various studies kind of courses, so African-American studies, gender studies, and so on and so forth. Those are the ones that usually hit first. And then next you get history and, all the other things. The idea is that this has been done in the name of efficiency, in the name of practicality. After all, if you want a college degree, you want something that can get you a job and so on and so forth. And of course, Nussbaum is not claiming that that's not what you should want, you should, but that is only one of the things you should want out of education. The other thing that you should want out of education is the ability to think critically about society at large, particularly in a multicultural society where you have to deal with different religions, different ethnic groups, different histories, complex issues that a more technical type of education simply does not prepare you mm-hmm. for. So I highly recommend the book. It's very well written. It's a quick read. And I'm sure it will generate quite a bit of food for thought.
Hmm. And, of course, the question of whether humanities departments at universities actually do help students think critically is one that we've discussed on an earlier episode of our podcast on teaching the humanities.
Correct.
And I gave Massimo a bit of friction on that issue then. But I'm curious to read what Nussbaum has to say on the subject. right, we are all out of time. So this concludes another episode of the Rationally Speaking podcast. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollock and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.